Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The world can breathe more deeply now that a huge piece of tropical rainforest is destined to remain a rainforest rather than a soybean field. And all those people who live in the Brazilian rainforest just took a deep breath too, and maybe got a better night's sleep, knowing their lands could remain theirs. We look at the future of the Brazilian rainforest when your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News. We continue our discussion with Dr. Gustavo Fonseca of Conservation International. I'd like to talk a little bit about the politics, and the way I'd like to start out with that is, first, I'd like to say that for listeners who wish to envision the size of this landmass in the U.S. here, of course, people would say it's about the size of the state of Illinois. That's a big state. It's a lot of land that has been involved in this one announcement that therefore creates a much larger contiguous area. How much would you say it actually has cost? What does it cost in terms of dollars to achieve this level of preservation in Brazil?
This is a very difficult question to answer. I mean, it hasn't up to this stage required a lot of resources. What the resources that went into producing these political commitments have been basically the technical studies that produced an ecological/economic zoning plan for the state of Pará in this case that showed that these forests, the best use of these forests, were for conservation and for sustainable development. And those technical studies, and together with all the field surveys that needed to be done, all the demarcation process, we are talking about the low millions of dollars in order to put those plans and those commitments in place, and now to implement the first steps towards the actual establishment, the physical establishment of these areas. But over time, it will demand the creation of what we call conservation trust funds, and we've been doing this in a number of different places. For instance, in Suriname, we are beginning to have a trust fund be put in place with $1 million of seed money that is being matched by all the donors. That we have a target of about $15 million over time. In Madagascar, we've done a similar process that already has about $30 million committed to a trust fund, and the proceeds of these trust fund goes for the recurrent costs that these areas require. But when it comes to places like this in the Amazon, the cost varies a lot because most of these places have, at this stage, a very low threat, meaning there isn't an immediate threat of their conversion. It's a question of over time monitoring the emerging challenges that usually face these places and trying to provide the necessary responses. So the prices will vary a lot, and the money will vary a lot. But for a place like this, we are talking about over time creating trust funds that will be in the order of the tens of millions of dollars if we are to sustain these political commitments within, you know, let's say 50 to 100 years. We don't need all of those resources up front. What we need is to build those financial mechanisms as we go along. One of the biggest opportunities we have now is with the emerging carbon market. As we know, 20% of all of the climate change problem in the world is derived from deforestation. A lot of that comes actually from this particular region, from the Amazon. If we can get credits for avoided deforestation, for the storage of carbon that we have in these places, and use that those credits to internalize these resources, we believe that there's more than enough money to sustain these places over time. So what we need is to be creative about, again, as I said before, being able to value the ecosystem services that are provided by these standing forests and be able to internalize those those costs in favor of their preservation.
What impresses me is when you talk about tens of millions of dollars. I live down here in San Diego, where if you were to add up the property values on any particular street, it comes up to a similar kind of dollar amount. So when you understand the effectiveness of the money spent invested in our future in this way, it's minuscule.
It is absolutely minuscule. Yeah. And we've done a study about 5 years ago, and trying to get a sense of what it costs to fill all the gaps in terms of coverage of protected areas in places that are irreplaceable around the world for biodiversity conservation purposes. And we came to the figure of about $20 to $25 billion that would be required. And, you know, it may sound like a lot of money, but if you think like, you know, compare it with what we spend in soft drinks in the U.S., it's about, this amount that I mentioned, $24 billion, is half of what, you know, we spend in sodas in the United States every year. So that's a good comparison to show that for a relatively small investment, we can have a lot of outcomes in terms of conservation. Conversely, if we don't invest this money, we can have a lot of things go bad, both in terms of the provision of ecosystem services, in terms of social problems that derive by liquidating these resources. So it's an immense bargain at this stage, particularly in these places that we call high biodiversity wilderness areas.
It also affects people all around the world, because these tropical zones are the filters, the oxygen producers, and the CO2 sequesterers, natural systems that provide this service to us. So therefore, as you say, the money that's spent in this affects us as well, because it affects our health and the prospect of the damages that we're discussing in terms of global warming as we look out into the future.
But there's no doubt about it. And there are models that are coming out now showing that the interaction of deforestation and anticipated climate change really are going to be affecting places that are far removed from where deforestation takes place. The Amazon in particular has a very interesting dynamic, and some recent models have shown that, again, the synergy between climate change and deforestation are bound to affect places in the U.S., the Corn Belt of the U.S., and changing the productivity levels of that particular region. So there is a lot of connectivity in natural systems in terms of what how you feel the impact of something that happens far removed from where you are. So we are in a single system, and increasingly local impacts have global repercussions. Before, when we were only about, you know, a billion people, we had a lot of local impact when population, of course, changed their natural surroundings, but those local impacts did not amount and add up to a global impact. Now we are seeing that that's the case, and unless we act as a global community to try to really you know, get our hands together and help those who can make a difference and changing this situation, I think we're going to be in deep trouble. The good thing is that we actually can act now, and we can act strategically, and we can have a focused action. We have resources that exist to have a big effect. But this window of opportunity will not last for, you know, more than, I would say, 10 or 15 years. In places like this, I would guess that unless we act now, in, you know, 20 years, we would face a very different situation. And things are changing very rapidly. The biggest impact for these wilderness areas is, of course, infrastructure development, road development, energy development. And there are plans for all those emerging rapidly. So the best that we can do at this stage is precisely what happened in Paraná, is discipline land use before infrastructure development picks up, because by taking those valuable lands out of the, what we call in Brazil, the land-grabbing market, you actually have a huge effect in what happens with forests. We've seen this in time series analysis in many places of the Amazon, where indigenous lands and protected areas have a huge effect in arresting deforestation along the frontier zone, whereby you can actually see in satellite pictures where a reserve starts and where it ends just by looking where a forest has been standing, both inside reserves as well as inside indigenous territories. Now we are up to about 45% of the Brazilian Amazon in either one of these two major categories, indigenous lands or protected areas, and that's a major accomplishment. But we still are far from, I would say, the ideal, which would be at least 70% zoned for some kind of a low-impact use that removes these low-value uses of land, such as cattle ranching and slash-and-burn agriculture.
You started out this conversation by talking about a change that's happening in the area from a political perspective, and I think that's a very important aspect. I'd like to briefly have you give us your thoughts about that. In other words, as you say, traditionally, politicians were pretty much bought off one way or another, and therefore the natural resources were being exploited, the forests were being torn out, almost without any sort of concern about the consequences. What is driving this political change, therefore? Because that becomes a model for other politicians, which are going to be faced with these same types of dilemmas all throughout that region.
Well, it takes two things. It takes enlightened politicians, but also, more than anything, it takes a growing consciousness on the part of the voters and part of the constituency. And this is happening in the Amazon because the local population has seen what happens when you liquidate natural resources on a more predatory basis and what's left behind in terms of social problems, very little to take away from the land, the social problems, the disaggregation of culture, of indigenous cultures and also local cultures that are left after this wave of predatory mining of resources, both logs and mining and predatory fishing, as opposed to those communities that have conserved their natural resources and have used them sustainably, and they are faring much better. So there's a lot of realization from the voters themselves that that's a better future than what they have been presented in the past. So it takes both sides, but of course it takes also politicians that are willing to be courageous enough to support those trends and those commitments. So I think that we are seeing that happening there because there's enough experience with the bad side of development to be able to open people's minds to what should be done into the future.
That's actually an amazing story and a very important one right now, and that is that in areas like that, indigenous democracy is having an effect on a larger scale. That's a total turnaround from the way things used to be. It's very, very, very encouraging that these people who have witnessed the devastation, who are given a chance to make a choice in a democratic process, are making wise choices. That's an extraordinary story.
Yes, and they are becoming also much more organized locally and becoming more active in the way that resources get managed and how they see themselves within that particular environment. Of course, this is also possible because there has been support from international organizations, some funding institutions that help, for instance, indigenous lands to be demarcated over the past 15 years or so. So with the legal titling of these lands, they were, again, taken out of this very destructive land-grabbing market that's very violent, that has resulted in the past, and even in the recent past, in violent conflict that led, for instance, to the assassination of Sister Dorothy Strang. It's less than a couple of years ago. So by zoning, by really providing people with the rights to the land that they have, it really makes a huge difference. And this is was only possible because there was resources available to do that. So we need to keep moving. We need to be able to find the resources. We need to be able to mobilize the technical expertise that is required in this kind of work. And by doing that, the communities are really able to make a quantum leap in the way that they relate to their natural capital and the way that they take control of their future.
We're talking with Dr. Gustavo Fonseca with Conservation International. So at this point, as you look into the future, how do you see this particular development, this extraordinary success story, in terms of the overall picture in South America and the tropical rainforest? How does this, where does this fit, and how do you see this impacting the future, the real future needs?
I think this is inspiring. I think this is another milestone that people will look into and become really motivated to rally around. But it's a milestone. It's not the outcome itself. It's a very important, as I said before, political commitment. But this political commitment needs to be accompanied by financial resources that are not to be found solely nationally, but increasingly internationally. So the international financial institutions, the developed countries that benefit from the services that are being provided by these ecosystems that are being in turn conserved by local communities need to be rewarded for that service. So we need to move ahead and need to be able to demonstrate that these commitments can be done, but it's just one step. So we are just beginning to work towards that goal. We haven't gotten there yet.
Well, Dr. Gustavo Fonseca of Conservation International, terrific work. This is a great story and really demonstrates the fact that long, hard, dedicated, intelligent, wise commitment to the earth and the environment is beginning to truly pay off. We just have to keep this momentum moving forward. For people who want to find out more about this particular project as well as what's happening with Conservation International, tell them how they can find out more.
Well, they can go to our website, www.conservation.org. We have links also to all of the partner institutions that work with us. We don't act alone. We have over 600 organizations that work with us, our partners in this mission of ours. In this particular recent one in Brazil, IMAZON, the Institute for Man and the Environment, which is a very capable institution in Brazil, has done a lot of the groundwork that led to this designation of new protected areas. So if you go to www.conservation.org, you can find not only about our work, but the work of hundreds of organizations that are committed to the same cause around the world. It's this network that is required to make conservation occur globally.
Well, Conservation International, as I say, and I'll restate it, I think is probably the premier success story in terms of wise use of resources, targeted mission, and accomplishment. Dr. Gustavo Fonseca, thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Preserving the wonder comes in many forms. For millions of years, the Earth has locked its history into some of the most amazing and beautiful forms. And now, millions of years later, they are valued as priceless beauty and wonder. This last week saw some record auction results for some of the world's most spectacular natural history specimens. Stay tuned as we head to Los Angeles and the Bonham and Butterfield's Natural History Auction. You'll be glad you did.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.